Ready? Let's go. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a golf course.
70 courses!
Let's get a water sport.
Paddleboarding!
Can I get excursions?
Whale watching!
Time for chill vibes.
Beach yoga!
How about a garden tour?
Balboa Park!
Give me a dolphin. What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Hey everyone, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets, in the car while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Citizen Chef is a production of iHeartRadio. Hi, I'm Tom Colicchio, and you're listening to Citizen Chef. So this week on our podcast, I'm talking to Congressman Earl Blumenauer. He represents Portland, Oregon. And, you know, we talk about a lot of different things, ranging from food policy, the farm bill, school lunch. But we also talk about the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. Earl Blumenauer wrote the bill in the House. And since the bill, there's been a lot of sort of misunderstanding and sort of misinformation swirling around those interwebs out there. So obviously, when we wrote the bill, we wanted to take care of people who typically are marginalized. And so the bill was written where women, minority, and veteran-owned businesses got first crack at the funding. Okay, so after the applications were accepted, there was a two-week period, I think it was 2 weeks, where the only applications that were funded were those from minority-owned, women-owned, and veteran-owned businesses. Well, a couple weeks into the funding process, there was a lawsuit. The SBA, the Small Business Administration that was administering the program, they were sued, saying that they couldn't prioritize these groups. And the lawsuit was successful. And there were people who received phone calls saying that, yes, you were going to get funded, but now we have to pull it back. So a couple weeks into it, some of the priority applicants were told that, yes, they were going to be funded. And then the SBA actually had to rescind that because of this lawsuit. We tried to fight the lawsuit, the Independent Restaurant Coalition. We didn't have standing, couldn't do it. Now, we're hearing stories from people who thought they were going to receive a grant and then the money got pulled back and they started spending money and it's horrible. And that's what we're still fighting to make sure that those people get funding. Also, listen, you could get your information from your social media feeds and there's, again, a lot of misinformation out there. Or you could just go to the SBA site and actually see the data. I mean, the Independent Restaurant Coalition actually put in a FOIA request. But you can go right to the SBA website, download all the information you want. And I'll put out some more information. 85,406 businesses from urban areas received relief. 15,598 businesses from rural areas received relief. There's tons of information. Again, we could focus on individuals, Michelin-starred restaurants, you know, that received money. That's fine. Or we could focus on where the bulk of the money went to. But we have a long way to go. And what we need right now are all voices in the restaurant industry to make sure that Congress knows that we still have a long way to go. There is another bill that is hopefully working its way through Congress as well right now, both in the Senate and the House, that will add $60 billion to the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. That $60 billion will cover every single application that is currently at the SBA, and that the $60 billion will make everyone whole. That's where we need to focus our efforts right now. Anything short of that is not helping. So with that, this interview was about 4 weeks ago with Congressman Blumenauer, but so much of what we discussed then is pertinent to where we are right now. And then once we get through the Restaurant Revitalization Fund, we get into food policy. So I hope you enjoy it. So let's bring in Congressman Blumenauer. Earl Blumenauer, welcome to the Citizen Chef Podcast.
I've been looking forward to this conversation, Tom.
Yeah, well, we've had many conversations over the years, and you know, there's a lot that I want to cover today. So this season, we're talking directly, you know, to lawmakers, people who are involved in making food, preparing food, but also people who are involved in creating legislation around food. And there's so much that I want to cover. Want to get into a little bit about Portland passing the psilocybin, legalizing psilocybin. I know that was a local law, but I'm sure you have some, you can opine on that. Really want to focus in on the Green New Deal. These are the two things that I think that you're expert at, the environment and food and the cross-section between the two. And so I want to talk a little bit about food, farming, and the Green New Deal. And obviously want to talk Restaurant Act. That's where we'll start. And going back to the early days of the pandemic, March, I think, 13th, restaurants, at least in New York, were forced to close. Restaurants in Portland, I'm not sure if they were already closed, but you were already working with a bunch of local chefs and restaurateurs in Portland to try to get them help. Way before the Independent Restaurant Coalition was formed, when did you realize the position that restaurants were in and they needed help? What alerted you to this?
Well, it's the communication with the local restaurant leadership. I mean, these people, as you know from your own experience in Portland, they're a passionate group, they're creative, they're hardworking, and they were just being hammered. We weren't able to be able to take advantage of the PPP program that when restaurants didn't even know if they were going to be in business in 8 or 10 weeks, let alone taking on more debt. We started the conversation right away thinking about what might happen. They were terrific in terms of brainstorming. It quickly led to a broader conversation with your colleagues around the country. It's been one of the most rewarding experiences that I had. And it was a great pleasure for me to watch our people understand, roll up their sleeves, and be serious about what would make a difference for them.
We were constantly, you know, on TV, on the news, working the phones. But there was a whole education process. I mean, you adapted very quickly, understood this, you know, right from the bat. But how difficult was it to get your colleagues on both sides of the aisle on board?
Well, part of our problem was that there was an avalanche of need, a lot of bad news. We were struggling with the beginning of the pandemic, lots of uncertainty. It was hard to cut through all that clutter. But I'll tell you, when the IRC, the Independent Restaurant Coalition, galvanized around some very specific items that would make a difference in such a relentless way, we started to get through. It is a compelling story. And at a time when we were overwhelmed by a lot of bad news with the pandemic, there were challenges galore. There are political problems back here. But there was a certain clarity when it came to protecting our local restaurant scene. There's such a connection that people have with their local diner or their restaurant or the people they know who provide the leadership that it cut through that clutter. There was a clarity unlike any that I saw with any of the other issues regarding the pandemic. And that made a difference in terms of being able to have a specific proposal, having that focus, and starting the relentless effort of signing up the leadership to join us, which you, of course, were a key part of.
We had plenty of help. I mean, this was truly a bipartisan effort. And often, you know, we don't see it. Obviously, if you follow the news, follow politics at all, you know that things just are at a standstill because both sides just can't seem to agree on anything. And this was one issue where both sides came together. What do you attribute that to?
Well, part of it is that how essential the restaurant industry is for every community. I mean, this is the first job for a lot of people. It's the easy access that is so real for so many people. Part of the problem is that there was difficulty in getting people to align in paying for it. But in terms of the need, in terms of what difference the restaurants made and the affinity, people really believe in their restaurant community. And that made a big difference. So we were able to get bipartisan support in the center. Roger Wicker, God love him, was there from the beginning. Chuck Schumer was a very aggressive leader. Having Nancy Pelosi make a commitment early, she carved out at a time when we were cutting back on the size of some of the rescue packages. She carved out space for $120 billion in the House version. And so those elements really came together and reinforced one another. And we were able to keep it in the package. And I think it puts us in a position where we can work to replenish the fund going forward.
Anytime you have John Cornyn and Elizabeth Warren on the same side of an issue, you know you have bipartisan support. And that's what was really amazing to see, how everybody came around and they understood it. This became a nonpartisan issue, really. This became an issue of communities, even farmers and winemakers. And so if you were a region where you had small farmers that supply restaurants, you understood this. If you were in a wine growing region, if you were, but even your local plumber and electricians, those are all part of the restaurant community. And those are all people who really benefited from this.
That's a very powerful point. The supply chain is what, $1 trillion? And it is the plumber, the electrician, it's the people who provide the linens, as well as the ancillary services. And there's real power in understanding the strength and the depth of that supply chain.
Right, right. Now, one of the key features of the Restaurant Act, which became the Restaurant Revitalization Fund, and this was by design, was that minorities and women-owned businesses and veterans were actually to get first crack at the money, the $28.6 billion that was funded.
Right.
And now we see the SBA is under attack right now by a few different people, a few different lawsuits, because they think that some people think it was unfair that we singled out those particular groups first. What I find very interesting is often you hear about minorities getting a first, but I don't hear anybody complaining about veterans. But the SBA is in a tough position right now. I think the listeners need to understand that obviously, yes, the restaurants are picking up. Stories are being written about restaurants coming back. But this bill and this money isn't necessarily going to end up in pockets of restaurateurs and things like that. Number one, there are provisions in this bill that actually I think are really elegant. Number one, it's a loan. It starts off as a loan, but you have to use that money by date certain and for qualified expenses, or you have to return the money. But also, as busy as we are, as busy as the press wants us to make it out right now, 2 months of revenue, of good revenue, is not going to make up for 15 months of almost no revenue. And so, just me personally, my landlords have been working with me, but they're not forgiving my rent. They're just deferring it. I still need to pay them. So, and there are so many, chefs and restaurateurs across the country that are in that same position.
Also, we've had people, and the conversations I've had with the industry around the country, there are people, who raided their retirement funds, that they've had to put a lot of capital, putting themselves at risk. And also, firsthand, it's more expensive in this climate. There is, in terms of staffing, in terms of cleanliness, in terms of operations. So it's there are people that have taken a beating. There are people that have had to raid the piggy bank. There are people that have higher costs. So I think this money is just sort of helping them normalize and deal with the extra costs, strain, and expenses in this COVID climate.
I think we still have a long way to go, with or without funding. We have a long, long way to go to get on the other side of this pandemic. Restaurants are still closing. So it's been a tough environment.
And this is something that we really hope to be able to work with you in the industry, trying to illustrate that this is a lifeline, but it'll help them negotiate what's going to be the new normal for another year. On everything from workforce issues to cleanliness to hours of operation.
Sure.
I think it illustrates the need, but I think it helps us build the momentum that people start to understand that we're not through this and that people really need this help.
Mm-hmm. We'll be back with more Citizen Chef.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Let's get back into my discussion with Congressman Earl Blumenauer of Oregon. So let's move for a second to the work that you did when you were on. You're no longer on the Ag Committee, right? But I think your heart's still there. When people hear about the Green New Deal, the amount of carbon emissions that food production causes, how the two could really come together so we could obviously produce food in a way that's less harmful to the environment. Where do you see the intersection between food and the Green New Deal?
I think too few people recognize the enormous carbon footprint that modern agriculture has. The industrial version of agriculture is very carbon intense, very petrochemical intense. Lots of emissions, water pollution. Being able to deal in a more sustainable basis in terms of different ways of growing food, in terms of non-industrial meat production, which is huge. The health implications for being able to have a healthy diet. It's health, it's carbon and climate, it is the economic vision. I have been excited that people understand what we can do with regenerative agriculture.
Explain that, regenerative agriculture.
The notion here is having what we would say is traditional agriculture, the way that farming used to occur. Animals actually were in a pasture. They were fed scraps. The fertilizer from manure and animal waste was reincorporated into the farm, a natural fertilization, not chemical. There was and is a symmetry for people who engage in this type of regenerative agriculture. They care about the health of soil. And these are concepts that are as old as human settlement and agriculture, but we're now rediscovering the power of these concepts. It also adds value to the product. If you have a healthy soil that you're not spending so much on chemical inputs, you're not disrupting the soil, releasing carbon, things like cover crops make it more productive. It's an entirely different mindset, and it is one that is sustainable. It is one that has much less carbon input, and it has greater satisfaction, I think, for the people who practice it.
In the next farm bill, are there incentives that you see that can be given to farmers that are practicing regenerative methods of farming? Sequestering carbon, obviously, is a big one. What can we do to incentivize farmers to practice regenerative agriculture?
Well, first and foremost, we need to reduce the amount of subsidization for the industrial agricultural model. We put so much money into trying to have confined animal feedlots. These are extraordinarily destructive for communities when you have huge amounts of animals crammed together, producing a significant amount of waste, the methane that comes from the cattle, the hog lagoons. We need to stop subsidizing that industrial meat production. We need to be able to provide support for people who are producing fruits and vegetables. There are programs for environmental protection, but they are not performance-based. So they are not targeted for people that are actually strengthening soil health and reducing pollution and carbon. That's a change that needs to take place. We watched in terms of the trade war that Donald Trump had, there are tens of billions of dollars that flowed to large agricultural producers. And you mentioned crop insurance. There are people who get paid to plant crops they know will fail. But your suppliers of fruits and vegetables, people who are producing it on a sustainable basis, they don't get that degree of support.
Right. It's almost impossible for a fruit and vegetable farmer to get the crop insurance subsidies. They're just not available, especially a small farmer.
Right. So what we want to do is to be able to provide subsidy for what people are doing in terms of reducing their carbon footprint, protecting water and air quality, subsidize what we want, and allow them to compete in the marketplace without undue subsidies for the big industrial farming operation. If we level that playing field, I think that's an important step forward. There's also work that we can do for helping beginning farmers. You shouldn't have to, you know, be some huge mega industrial farm. There's lots, as you know, of young people who want to get into this business. Being able to protect farmland itself, buying up and subsidizing development rights for people who want to keep that farm in farm production forever. Let's pay them to keep it in production forever.
And so do you see working through already established land trusts to do that? Because out here, I'm out in the North Fork of Long Island, which is actually a farming community. And traditionally, it was cauliflower, broccoli, potatoes, hops a long time ago. And now more and more, we're seeing more some animals being produced. We're also seeing it's a lot of wine out here. But what we're seeing is that a lot of young farmers, you're right, they can't find the capital to either buy property. And so what you're seeing is a lot of wealthy people buying up land, and they do farm it. They'll bring a farmer on to farm it, but they're farming a small amount of it.
Right.
But it's only for the wealthy that can actually become gentleman farmers.
Right.
You don't see a lot of young people. And you do see a lot of family farms being sold off because the kids don't want to farm anymore. They don't see a future in it. And so do you see working through existing land trusts or creating new land trusts for that vehicle?
All of the above, Tom, because there is a lot of farmland now. And if people think about it, they don't want it to be subdivided. They do want to protect it. There are a number of people that will accept payment to be able to protect this land forever. Land trusts are a tremendous tool. There are other areas in terms of being able to, Iowa, most of the farms are owned by elderly women who are widows,
right.
and they sort of rent it out. There are opportunities to be able to help them and their children and grandchildren. I mentioned being able to buy up development rights, have conservation easements. These are tools that in many cases have been pioneered by the land trust.
So we have the Peconic Land Trust out here, and I was introduced to them. We bought this house about 20 years ago, and at the closing, I was charged, I think, 3.5% for the land trust. And
it was really? Oh, yeah.
At the closing, yeah, they tax you on the closing, and that goes into the land trust, and the land trust does exactly that. They buy up development rights.
Cool.
And so if you have a 40-acre farm, you sell development rights, and they sell usually for about 100 years. And this way, you get that capital to put into the farm. You can't develop it, so you can't build homes on it. The Peconic Land Trust has done a great job out here. But yeah, at the closing, I was like, well, that seems pretty unfair. But then I thought about it after about 10 minutes and realized what they did. It was like, wow, this is one way to do it in terms of keeping these farming communities intact.
And what we're seeing is that there's greater appreciation for the ability to grow crops virtually anywhere. I mean, we've got people in New York City that are doing hydroponic farming. There's urban agriculture in Detroit, in Chicago, in New York. There's reclaiming land. I am quite confident that if we had the right array of subsidies and incentives, that we can stop the erosion of the land base. We can add to it, make it more productive. You know, and as you know very well, people can take a couple of acres and produce a tremendous amount of high quality fruits and vegetables that add so much value to the equation. I remember the very first field trip I had dealing with agricultural issues was with Tammy Baldwin in Madison.
Tammy Baldwin was a senator from Wisconsin.
Yeah. And this was when she was first running for the House. And there was an iconic restaurant in Madison, Piper Odessa or Odessa Piper. And it was, they brought these people in. And Tom, I was stunned. There was somebody who had a 2-acre hoop hut production for spinach. Mm-hmm. And there was a dish prepared. It didn't even taste like spinach. And it lasts longer. There's less waste. They get more value. I mean, these are things that using the restaurant power of the people who really understand food and how to prepare it and how to appreciate it. I think there's so much more value that can be coaxed out. And that should be part of the new farm bill and a new vision for American agriculture that's much more inclusive.
Last episode, we had a woman chef who started the first cannabis cafe in Los Angeles. Where do you see the role that cannabis has? Obviously, it has a role to play in both agriculture and food. Where do you see the two fitting in?
Well, I have witnessed the emergence of people who combine their culinary skills with cannabis. There have been curated dinners where there are cannabis products that are a part of this, cannabis-infused pastries. In the Pacific Northwest, we're quite proud of our wine industry. I think we're going to have cannabis tourism. And if it's done right and done carefully, I think there's a tremendous potential. And there's a local chef who's been in Portland, who's been involved in this for a number of years. I think it's going to grow. I think it ties various people's passions, and it's. I think it has a tremendous potential to add value to that sort of experience. We actually passed a piece of legislation. We called it the MORE Act in the House, which would have completely legalized. We passed legislation. We called it the Safe Banking Act. It's insane that state legal marijuana businesses can't have access to normal banking services.
And let's be clear, some of these are publicly traded companies.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This year, it's going to be about a $20 billion industry. It's going to have over 350,000 people who are employed. And as you mentioned, it's 98% of the American public has access to some form of state legal cannabis. We got these things passed. They got stuck in Mitch McConnell's hospice program in the Senate to die. But this Congress, we have Chuck Schumer, Cory Booker, and Ron Wyden in the Senate who are helping lead the charge. So this stuff is not going to get bottled up. We've already passed the Safe Banking Act again in this Congress. So I think the federal government is positioned. Now, part of the problem is that the politics are complex. And part of what we need to do is atone for the rank discrimination in terms of the selective enforcement of prohibition, particularly against people of color. We helped destroy 1 million young black men's lives because of this. So we've got a lot of energy and interest in racial restorative justice. But these pieces are coming together. I'm cautiously optimistic that this might be the session of Congress that we've finally solved this once and for all.
legalizing marijuana can really help with the opioid crisis that we still have in this country. I can tell you from personal experience, I had neck surgery and started taking opioids for pain and started getting into a really dark place. And partly because, I'll be honest, partly because, you know, drug experience I had when I was, a young adult, I saw where I was heading and very quickly got myself off opioids, but only was able to deal with the pain through using cannabis. It worked firsthand. Do we see, is it, are big pharmaceuticals pushing against the legalization of cannabis? Who's funding this?
We have seen some pharmaceutical opposition. For example, a campaign in Arizona a couple of years ago, there was a pharmaceutical giant that weighed in. It basically does not have a real strong opposition anymore. This is kind of, the opposition is melted away in part because the public support is overwhelming. More than 2-to-1 adults support full legalization. And if you're talking about medical cannabis, it's like the 4th of July. These are things that people recognize and they support. There's so much that's taken place in the various states that it's not as coordinated and focused. And so that's been a bit of a challenge. But we're to a point now where I think that corner is being turned, and it's been driven by local advocates, by the industry. It's been driven by experience like you've mentioned. States that have a robust medical marijuana have fewer opioid deaths by far. It's something that really helps people deal with depression, with pain, chronic pain, traumatic brain injury, the PTSD, epilepsy. It has made a huge difference in terms of extreme nausea that comes from chemotherapy. I mean, across the board, this works and people know it.
There's also, so Portland, I believe, passed legalized psilocybin for medical use. And same thing there. We're seeing either all sorts of psychedelics, whether it's LSD, psilocybin, and other drugs that are used to treat anything from PTSD. I know there's some trials of children on the spectrum that are using psychedelics as well. It seems to be great success. Have you seen any legislation at all on a federal level to legalize any of these other schedule one drugs? Right.
There is some movement in that direction. The Oregon ballot measure approved it in a clinical setting, and it's more of a trial. It's going to be an opportunity for us to really evaluate its impact with professionals who are trained. At the same time, Oregon passed a ballot measure that decriminalized the use of drugs. It didn't legalize it, but we weren't going to throw people in jail if they were using illicit drugs. Prohibition hasn't worked. I mentioned the selective enforcement. And we think these two things, one is sort of being able to clinically examine the impact of psilocybin by professional therapists to really do this right and stop enforcing in a draconian sense, the prohibition is, I think, the direction that we as a society need to go.
The other thing that I think we're both passionate about is making sure that people who live in this country aren't hungry. Because of COVID, it seems like we made some pretty good gains, increased SNAP funding by 15%, community eligibility, community certification is much more robust. There are plenty of anti-hunger advocates that believe that we cannot continue to just manage hunger. We can end hunger in this country. And I think what we saw during COVID is we saw these long lines in the news of people lined up for hours waiting for food from local food pantries. And, you know, I looked in those lines and I saw a lot of Mercedes and BMWs as well. And so these were people who were never in a million years thought that they would be online waiting for someone to help them out. And so I'm hopeful that there's a greater sense of empathy for people who are struggling because a lot of people who weren't found themselves in a really tough position. Do you think we can get the necessary funding to pretty much end hunger in this country? We almost did it back in the 70s, actually under Richard Nixon, helped to modernize SNAP and WIC and school and lunch and pretty much get hunger under control until the 80s, and then that all changed. But do you think we have an opportunity to really end hunger?
You know, Tom, I really do. And you've been in the middle of a variety of conversations that point to the ways that we can do this. First and foremost, we talked earlier about good, healthy food is a way to control healthcare costs. We ought to be able to reach a point where the big healthcare providers can write prescriptions for healthy food.
Right. There is a prescription drug plan. It's actually Wholesome Wave is a big proponent of that. And there are doctors now who are writing prescriptions for healthy fruits and vegetables, and it works.
By the same token, what's happened in terms of providing food for our children during this COVID crisis, we've recognized, well, let's expand the school nutrition program. And let's not worry about, you know, kids paying $1.19 that the family may or may not have for. Just do away with it. In fact, the bookkeeping is almost as expensive as what comes in. Make food a right. Being able to expand that awareness. Kids learn better if they're adequately nourished.
Right. There was a study done by Deloitte and No Kid Hungry that when kids get breakfast in first period, math scores go up by 17%. Any teacher out there, if they can snap their finger and make math scores go up by 17% just by feeding kids in first period, and in first period, not before the bell, because before the bell, a lot of the kids don't go. Sometimes transportation's not working that early. Plus, there's a stigma involved in getting to school early and being that kid. And so this is documented.
All these things that come together, Tom, in terms of the food supply chain, is healthier for the environment and for the community. Being able to engage the economic power, being able to deal with the health consequences, what you just said in terms of improved school performance. When you tie all these things together, of course we can afford it. Of course we can afford it.
Often you hear people say, well, we should have a businessman running the country. And you know, it sounds good. It didn't work out that well. But, you know, again, the last guy wasn't really a businessman either. But here's the problem with that is that because of our 2 and 4 year election cycle, 6 years in terms of senators, most corporate CEOs plan for 5, 10, and 15 years. And so you never get a sense that the government is looking that far down the road. And so you couldn't run this as a business because the election cycle doesn't run like a business. That and the fact that to really make all of the things that we're talking about happen, we need to have a functioning democracy. Do you think that we're at risk of losing our democracy? I mean, you look at all these voting rights acts that are being pushed back. I mean, do you think we can lose it?
Well, I'll tell you, I was here January 6th. And I think people now recognize that we came closer to losing it than people understood. But part of what we're talking about here with this conversation, Tom, are things that really bring people together rather than divide them. Having healthy, well-fed kids, supporting family farmers, being able to deal with the nutritional needs as well as what the environmental benefits. These are all things that are historic, traditional values. They are things that if we break them out and talk to people, they support them. These are things that do not need to divide us. Certainly, there are problems with industrial agriculture. But if we start providing a healthy, sustainable, regenerative alternative, I think that there is the potential of bringing people together on this alternative vision that is cheaper, that is healthier, is better for the environment and better for our families. And I think there's great power. And you've been part of this movement with some of the leading chefs in the country to be able to make these points, to be able to get food to kids, be able to keep restaurant supply chains. These are things that have been given more attention in the last 16 months than I think than ever before. So I'm excited about this to strengthen community, strengthen democracy, and strengthen families.
We'll be back with more Citizen Chef.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Listen, Earl, it's been great talking to you. Unfortunately, when I was in Portland shooting Top Chef, I was under quarantine, so I couldn't get out and break bread with you. But I am looking forward to seeing you in person soon. The one thing I wanted to ask you about is, whenever somebody meets you, the first thing they'll probably see is the bike lapel pin that you wear. Right under your congressional pin, you have it's like a wire bicycle. Tell me about that wire bicycle that you wear on your lapel.
Well, I started when I was Portland's Commissioner of Public Works. I started a pretty aggressive bike program. We started distributing these little pins. When I came to Congress, I brought bikes instead of a car. I started handing out the bike pins. I'm aggressively bike partisan. Everybody's got a bike story, and it's like food. Food brings people together. Well, cycling is something that everybody's got a cycling story. It's good for families. It's good for tourism. It's so the pin was a symbol of that. And it's a nice conversation starter. People like the pin. I'll take it off my lapel and give it to them.
Right. You gave me one. I think I have a neon green one. Yeah.
And I think part of, what you're good at doing and part of what we need to do a better job is to find ways, whether it's a bike pin or it's a comic book, The Fight for Food.
Yeah, let's talk about the Fight for Food book. I wanted to bring that up, actually. I'm glad you held that up. So this was your way of taking the Farm Bill, which is a pretty dense bill, and making it simple and easy for people to understand. Yeah, why was that so important?
One of our challenges in terms of getting the food policies that are right for America is that the Farm Bill itself is hopelessly complex, purposely so. Your friend Marion Nestle wrote that great essay, "The Farm Bill Drove Me Crazy." She's this famous nutrition professor. She tried to teach a course on the Farm Bill and she gave it up. She said, nobody understands it. And so what I did was boil this down into a little illustrated guide.
So we're on Zoom right now, and Earl is holding up his book, and it's the Farm Bill is hundreds of thousands of pages. It's more than a doorstop. And Earl boiled that down to a small pamphlet. It's what, about 4x3 and maybe 20 pages? And it's all boiled out. It's all in there.
Well, part of what we need to do is demystify this process. And that's why I love working with you and other professionals, is you get to the heart of the thing. What matters? What tastes good? What's sustainable? And so what we did was just boil this down in terms, we labeled it the Fight for Food. We gave a short description in a page. We have big graphics, you know, that you deserve better, a better farm bill. We talk about commodity programs, crop insurance, farm subsidies. When you boil it down to the essentials, you really can do this in about 16 pages in things that are simple enough that even a member of Congress can understand. And that's, I think, is what I think is so powerful as the work that we do with food and nutrition, is boiling it down to the basics. And when we do that, we don't have to make it hopelessly complex. We can talk about investing in what we care about, making it easier. And this was my contribution for people to understand what was at stake.
Well, I was happy to take a few cases and I had them at the podium of my restaurant. I would hand them out to people. And sometimes I got some interesting looks, but some people got back to me and said it was really helpful, and they really enjoyed it. So, well, listen, Earl, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I'm not scheduled to get down to either Portland or Washington anytime soon, but if you find yourself in New York and you want to grab a meal, let me know.
I will do it, my friend. Thank you very much.
Take care. Thanks.
Have a good day.
You too. Listen, that conversation was wide-ranging, but in a way, it really wasn't. We covered a lot of ground, and there's a lot of complex questions, and there's a lot of behind-the-scenes hand-wringing to make this happen, but it is pretty straightforward and simple. I think often politicians are maligned. We hear about the corruption and we hear about the pettiness, but I actually, you know, think members of Congress like Earl Blumenauer, they're there because they're just trying to make the country better for their constituents and for all Americans. And so it's great to have a member that is so plugged in, especially when it comes to the access of food, the environment, and how to make it fair for everybody. Thanks again to Congressman Earl Blumenauer for spending some time with us. And as always, a special thanks to Place the Table. And thank you for listening. Citizen Chef is executive produced by Christopher Hasiotis, produced by Gabby Collins, and researched by Lillian Holman. Citizen Chef is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts like this, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite shows.